Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. It's the most memorable line that I know of from Sir Walter Scott's epic poem, Marmion. It's where we get that phrase, web of lies. I'm sure you've seen this in your life at some point. If you haven't, I'm sure you will. That somebody will make a lie to cover their tracks. And then that lie will precipitate in another lie to cover that lie. And then it goes on. And then they have to lie again and again and again until there's this monstrous lie that they've created. And you know, one of, maybe you remember the classic example of this in VeggieTales. Right? With Larry Boy and the Fib from Outer Space, where Junior Asparagus, he tells us he's playing and he ends up breaking his father's plate. And so when his father confronts him, he blames Laura Carrot. And he says that she broke the plate. Well, then he has to make another lie. Now, he was actually encouraged to do this by this alien who showed up, Fibrilius Minimus, who's kind of the personification of his lie. And this alien happens to feed on lies. So every time that Junior tells another lie to cover his tracks, this alien gets bigger until he's this huge monster. So maybe that's not the best example, but you get the gist. That you create this one lie, and it's going to build and create this monster of the mess. I've seen this happen in real life. I've seen this happen where just simple lies end up snowballing into such a huge mess that it ruins relationships, ruins lives. And in all that, we need to recognize is nobody wins when there's a web of lies. Nobody except God. You say, now that sounds kind of crazy. Now, God is saddened by our sin. God does not want us to sin. And yet, nothing we do in those actions, in that web, actually deters or gets God's plan off track. What he's doing, his work, continues. And that's what we're going to see this morning. See that we're going to see a tangled web. It's the kind of thing that's tangled for us, but it's not tangled for God. And we see that in Genesis 26, verse 34, to Genesis 27, verse 40. This is a web that everybody's hand is involved in this passage. Everybody has a part that they play. Everybody suffers from it. Esau foreshadows the web. Isaac prepares the web. Rebecca plans the web, Jacob spins the web, and then Isaac and Esau get caught in the web. And that's what you see. Nobody wins except God. God's plans continue to go forward. And not just in this makeshift way, like God's changing and shifting and doing something to make good out of the evil. What you see is God's plans actually proceed seamlessly through this story. So let's look at how Esau foreshadows the web in the last two verses of Chapter 26, it says, when Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri, the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite. And they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. So these verses actually introduce a problem. So the last chapter hadn't talked about Esau or Jacob at all, and suddenly we're reintroduced to them. And it's raising this problem, a problem that the Israelites would have clearly seen as they read this. They understand what's at stake here. The promised land belongs to Israel, and yet Isaac has two sons. And they know who Esau is. He's the forebear of the Edomites. And they know that Jacob is their progenitor, the nation of Israel's. So when they read that the life of these two sons, the question is, well, how can Israel maintain the sole possession of the promised land? How does Edom not fit into this? What's going to happen? And they see that Edom, that Esau, he's mingling with the Canaanites. That's who the Hittites are here. So he is ruining the distinction between God's people, between the people that God is going to dispossess and the people God is going to give the land to. He's mingling those two. He's confusing them. So as they read this, it may seem random to us that you mentioned this shortly before this story, but it's actually ominous, and it's setting up the reality that there's a problem. So God's promises to Abraham, his covenant promises to Abraham, they had just been passed on to Isaac in the last chapter. We saw that. So with that still ringing in their ears, they read about this mess that Esau is creating. And again, the Hittites there, they're the Canaanites. That it's just another term for some of the people who made up the Canaanites. So what you see in just those two verses is Esau is still acting on the basis of his desires. He's just doing what he wants to do. He's just taking the wives that he wants to take. He's not considering his parents. He's not considering God in this. So it's on that basis he creates this bitterness. We don't know how these two women and this marriage, these marriages made life bitter. We do know that the Bible never, ever, ever, ever presents polygamy positively. So that would be an ominous thing. As soon as you see this happen, it's going to be negative. But we don't know exactly how they made life bitter. And yet, even after that, just brief but very problematic reality, it doesn't deter Isaac from doing what he does next. So look at how he prepares the web in verses 1 through 4. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here am I." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, and that my soul may bless you before I die." So Isaac, he's begun to experience the effects of age. He recognizes his mortality, and he wants to make sure that he's able to bless his son, his favorite son, before he dies. Now, the father's blessing, that was a very, very incredibly important thing in the ancient Near East and in the Bible. It was a prayer for the son's future. It wasn't just any prayer, though. This is a prayer that they viewed as powerful. So it could affect the rest of your life. They understood it to be that way. And it wasn't something you could revoke. Once you said it, you put it into motion. You put it into effect. So it was a very substantial prayer that he was going to hear. It wasn't the inheritance, so it didn't have to do with the birthright that Esau had already sold. This is something else, something in addition to that. So really, Isaac is setting the stage for this web because he's just inviting his favorite son. That's not the way they would do it in the ancient world. They would invite all their sons. So he asks Esau to go to make this meal. This is a solemn occasion, so he's making a special meal, the one that he, of course, likes, in order for him to carry out this ceremony so he could bless Esau and Esau alone. What he hasn't accounted for, though, is that there's a spy. Rebecca's there listening, and now she's ready to act. So Isaac is just prepared for the web. Rebecca now plans for it. Look at verses 5 through 13. It says, "Now Rebecca was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for the game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son, 'Jacob, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock and bring me 2 good young goats that I may prepare from them delicious food for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it to your father to eat so that he may bless you before he dies.' But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, 'Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing.' His mother said to him, 'Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go bring them to me.'" So Rebecca sees what's happening. Her son, her favorite son, is getting left out. He's being mistreated. She's not about to let that happen. So she then goes and tells Jacob what's happening. She brings him up to speed on what has just taken place. Now, notice what she adds to what Isaac said. So Isaac said nothing about doing this in the Lord's presence. But she quotes Isaac as saying that he would bless Esau before the Lord. I think she is drawing out the seriousness of what's about to happen. Because Isaac's blessing is more than just any fatherly blessing. He's just been promised a blessing from the Lord to his offspring. So what he says is going to be true with some certainty. And he's passing something on that's certain and true. It's not "I hope," that these good things will happen. Isaac knows that good things are going to come to his offspring. So this becomes much more certain and much more important. The creator of the universe has made promises. Now Isaac is trying to pass those on. So she lays out her plan. She stresses that Jacob needs to follow her instructions very carefully. She's very deliberate in her speech. So she says, here's what you're going to do, Jacob. You're going to go grab two goats, bring them to me. I'm going to prepare them just like Jacob, or just like Isaac likes, same recipe that he likes. You're going to go in and you're going to present this, act like your brother, and he's going to bless you instead of Esau. Now, Jacob sees an immediate problem, and he's thinking this through, and he knows that they're fraternal twins. It's pretty obvious that they're not identical twins. Esau is hairy. Jacob's more on the hairless side of life. So he mentions that fact to his mom, and he says, look, this is going to be a close encounter. There's a good chance that he's going to touch my hands or something, and he's going to know the difference. And so Rebecca's response, and what he's afraid of is that that Isaac is then going to think that he's mocking him. What he means by mocking is that he's going to be looking down on Isaac with contempt and really taking advantage of him. That's the idea. So when Isaac thinks that, he's going to curse him. He's not going to bless him. He's going to bring a curse down on him, and he doesn't want that to happen. And so he offers that perspective. Well, Rebecca, she offers herself then as a scapegoat. She says, I'm willing to take the curse. Now, we don't know how she would have necessarily done that. We don't know that there's some procedure that they believe they could take someone else's curse on them or not. She does say this, and there is, later on, under the law, the Day of Atonement has a goat where they would lay their hands on the goat, confess the sins of the people on the goat, then they would send the goat off into the wilderness to die for the sins of the people. So maybe she's thinking along those lines in some way, but in some way she's saying, let the curse be on me, I'll take it. And then she goes on to actually listen to what Jacob has said, and she kind of adjusts her plan there. So look in verse 14. It says, so he went and took them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared delicious food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the young goats she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. And she put the delicious food and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. So she dresses Jacob up in Esau's clothes. Now, he's obviously not going to wear his best clothes out to hunt. So they were there available for her. She put those on. And then she disguises him with his smooth skin with this goat hair. And the details are actually highlighted in the Hebrew. It's made prominent. But to us, it seems maybe a little weird that she just covers his hands and his neck. That's basically all that you would think Isaac would touch in this encounter, either from a hug or from reaching out, or when he kneels down to be blessed, his hand could reach the back of his neck. So that's all she provides. Now, I'm impressed with Rebecca and Jacob throwing that in there, but I'm impressed with Rebecca. Her plan here, I think, is pretty extensive. She's thought of a lot of things. Now, some people have downplayed this. I've heard many commentators say, this could never work. And they list out their disagreements about this, especially the idea that goat could pass as wild game. Here's the reality. I've had ground turkey before in the place of ground beef. And in certain meals, you can mask that with a recipe and say, well, no, I could never mask that. Well, supposedly right now they're making Whoppers out of vegetables and it's supposed to taste the same. So in some way, she is able to potentially mask the taste, the differences between the taste. That's what she's suggesting. And I think that's possible. I'm not an expert. I'm not a culinary expert. But neither is necessarily Isaac. She knows her husband. And she thinks that she can pull this off. And he's probably hungry on top of that. When you're hungry, things just taste good. So other point that people point out or that they say is a problem is that goat's hair and human hair, I mean, what are the chances that somebody mixed those two things up, right? Well, here's the thing. I doubt Isaac spent a lot of time running his fingers through Esau's neck hair or his hands. I think that's probably pretty weird even back then. So you got a guy, and we don't know how long he's been blind. We don't know how long he hasn't seen. So all that you really need is something for him to associate mentally with his son. And hairy neck is all that he would associate. We have no reason to think that he's this amazing person at distinguishing between types of hairs just because he's blind. So I don't think that's very, very big of a deal. And then the last thing that they bring out is the difference in voices. And that does prove to be an issue in what happens, as we'll see. But here's the reality. These guys are brothers. I have two other brothers who sound an awful lot like me. And there are times when I call my parents or they call our parents and my parents can't figure out who they're talking to. So, yeah, there are differences. But in an encounter, the differences might be so slight that it just might work. So I think that there's enough in this that it's realistic. It's not like it's a crazy thing. But now it's time for actually Jacob to pull this off. Isaac prepared the web. Rebekah's planned it. Now it's Jacob's turn. He's going to spin the web here starting in verse 18. So it says, "So he went to his father and said, 'My father.' And he said, 'Here I am.' 'Who are you, my son?' Jacob said to his father, 'I'm Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Now sit up and eat my game, and that your soul may bless me.' But Isaac said to his son, 'How is it that you found it so quickly, my son?' He answered, 'Because the Lord your God granted me success.' Then Isaac said to Jacob, 'Please come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not.' So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, 'The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau.' And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, 'Are you really my son Esau?' He answered, 'I am.' Then he said, 'Bring it near to me, that I may eat of my son's game and bless you.' So he brought it near to him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. And his father Isaac said to him, 'Come near and kiss me, my son.' So he came near and kissed him, and Isaac smelled the smell of his garments, and he blessed him. And he said, 'See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed.'" So Jacob comes in. It's a pretty ordinary scene. He comes in, he greets his father. Isaac greets him back, but he asks him which son it is. You notice that he does think it's his son when he says this, when he says, "Who are you, my son?" So Jacob then probably had rehearsed this at this point. He'd rehearsed his spiel, and he says, "Look, it's me, Esau, your firstborn. You know, I did exactly what you said. So come eat this wild game so you can bless me just like you said you wanted to." And trying to be casual, I'm sure. But Isaac immediately has a problem logically with what's happened. This is way too quick. And evidently, he had reasons to think that things might not be above board. In the last chapter, we know Isaac was quick to lie to get out of trouble. So there's a good chance lying is a pretty consistent part of this family's life. So he's unnerved because he knows his family. And he has enough sense to say, "Hold up, how in the world did you get here so quickly?" And Jacob thinks quickly. He says, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." So think about what he just did. Not only is he lying, now he's taking the Lord's name in vain. He's bringing the Lord into his lie, into his deception. And he also refers to him not as his own God. Notice that. Not as Esau's God. He refers to him as the Lord, your God. This is your God, Isaac. But he basically uses God's providence as an excuse. That he's saying God is able to do this. God had brought this animal in his path providentially. And yet he's acting like God's on the sidelines. That's how he's treating God. Now Isaac accepts the answer, but he's not convinced. So he tells Jacob to come closer so he can touch him to see if he's Esau. He touches his hands. And it works. But notice his response. He says it's Jacob's voice, but Esau's hands. So then he begins to bless him, but he's still not sure. And so he asks again, "Are you really my son Esau?" And Jacob at this point starts to wise up. He realizes, "I've spoken too much." So he gives a one-word answer in Hebrew. And it's rightly translated, "I am." Isaac didn't want his favorite dish to get cold, I'm sure. So he's like, "Okay, fine, we'll just go with this." And he eats. He can't think of any reason not to trust him at this point. He eats the food, he drinks some wine. It's a proper solemn meal. And he, when he's done eating, he still has one more test. He tells Jacob to come closer and give him a familial kiss, that kind of kiss that fathers and sons would give in the Near East. And he then gets the opportunity to smell Esau's clothes. And that's enough for him to be convinced. And he then draws this statement, this last thing that he says, from what he just smelled, the outdoors. And so he transitions to blessing by mentioning the outdoors that the Lord had blessed. And then look at what he says. Well, before that, I want you to just realize that all of Isaac's five senses have failed at this point. I mean, his sight's literally failed. He can't see. And you could say, well, his hearing didn't fail because he does pick up on a difference, but it's not enough to convince him. It fails to convince him. And then there's his sense of touch. He's able to discern hair, but not that it's goat hair. His sense of taste is not able to discern that it's goat meat. And finally, his sense of smell actually leads him astray because he does accurately smell the right thing. He smells Esau's clothes, but that's what actually leads him to make the wrong conclusion. So listen now, he gives this blessing. So listen to the substance of it in verses 28 and 29. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed be everyone who blesses you. So it's very clearly the nature of a blessing. He's not instructing Jacob on what he needs to do. He's telling what he wants God to do for Jacob. And the only difference between when God blesses people and when a human blesses people is with God, it's certain to come true. With humans, you know, they're making this prayerful wish. They're hoping that God will do these things. When God blesses humanity, it's absolutely certain that what he does, what he says, is going to take place. But in this particular occasion, again, this is the promise, or this is the blessing from one who has received God's promises. So for this paternal blessing, there's a great deal of certainty. So he begins by blessing Jacob agriculturally. The dew of heaven, the fatness of the earth, those are metaphors for just agricultural success. And he makes that more clear with the parallel statement there, plenty of grain and wine. So he's praying for Jacob's material success. He doesn't know it's Jacob, but that's what he's doing. He wants God to give his son more than enough, not just what he needs, but more than what he needs. And then in verse 29, he talks about his sovereignty over others. There's this minor theme in Genesis of kingship. See it in the beginning. God created them male and female, and he blessed them, and he said to rule over the rest of creation. So in that blessing, they're to rule. Then you have Abraham and Sarah. They're told that they're going to have kings in their line. And now you have this that's also following in line with that same idea, that there's kingship. And later on in chapter 49, you're going to have Jacob mention kingship in the line of Judah. So you can trace this line happening here. That's what Isaac is talking about here with Jacob, that he is going to be in charge, that others are going to serve and bow down to him in submission, that he is going to be Lord over them. This is including people groups and nations, he says, but more close to home, he says it's going to include his brothers and his mother's sons. Now, there's no reason to think that they actually had other brothers. I don't think that's really what it's talking about. But this is how you talk in blessings. So I think Isaac's, in the very least, laying out possible hope that maybe I could have more sons. Happened with his father. But he's saying, you are going to be over those sons. And then lastly, he echoes this blessing to Abraham from Genesis 12:3, where Jacob now, he's saying, has this unique status, this special relationship with the Lord, where he is going to protect him from others, and he's going to bring blessing to others who bless him. So it's very similar. Cursed be everyone who blesses you, and blessed be everyone who cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you. So that just about covers everything you can think of. I mean, he's blessing him with supremacy materially, socially, and spiritually. There's nothing else left. And remember, he thinks that he's done this for Esau. This all-encompassing blessing. He has no idea what's happened. So that web was foreshadowed by Esau. It was prepared by Isaac, planned by Rebekah, spun by Jacob. And now, actually, it has caught its victims. But they don't realize it yet. And so you see them realize that they're caught in the next few verses. So Isaac and Esau, they're caught in the web. Look, starting in verse 30. It says, as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. He also prepared delicious food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, let my father arise and eat of his son's game that you may bless me. His father Isaac said to him, who are you? He answered, I'm your son, your firstborn, Esau. Then Isaac trembled very violently and said, who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me and I ate it before you came? And I blessed him, yes, and he shall be blessed. As soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, bless me, even me also, O my father. But he said, your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing. Esau said, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing. Then he said, have you not reserved a blessing for me? Isaac answered and said to Esau, behold, I have made him lord over you and all his brothers. I have given to him for servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son? Esau said to his father, have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father. And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. The way that the first few verses there, or the first verse, mentions Isaac or Jacob slipping out, I mean, I get the impression that things have just worked out perfectly. And it couldn't have worked out any better. I mean, as soon as he steps out, that's when Esau steps in. And that's the impression you get. I mean, he has just pulled off the best heist ever. Danny Ocean has nothing on him. He has pulled it off, and he and Rebecca both. So the scene then shifts from this deception to something very sad, and then it becomes even more sad to the point of being pathetic with Esau, who comes in. At first, he's happy-go-lucky. He thinks everything's great. I mean, he's about to get the solo blessing from his father. He's about to experience this good thing. Everything is great, except it's not. And he walks in and he says something disconcertingly close to what Isaac had just heard. And Isaac this time doesn't assume it's his son. He just says, who are you? But you can tell he kind of knows who it is. And Esau just says, I'm your firstborn, of course. I'm here doing what you said. He has no idea. Notice Isaac's response. He does not question what Esau said at that point. He doesn't actually question Esau in any way. He realizes now the difference in tone and pronunciation. He can tell now that he really is talking to Esau. He doesn't question that. He doesn't ask for any reassurances. He just trembles violently. This is the kind of emotion that borders on fear, but it's the kind of gut-wrenching emotion when you just know something terrible and irredeemable has just happened. There's nothing you can do about it. That's what Isaac is feeling at that point. He knows it's Esau. So he asks a question to really fill Esau in. It's more of a rhetorical question what he asks. And he shows it's rhetorical because in verse 35, when he clarifies it, he's telling him, here's what has happened. What's important is to notice that Isaac does believe God's promises here. He knew that this blessing would take place. He believed what God had told him back in chapter 26. That's why he says, yes, he shall be blessed. And he knew there was no way to retract it. He knew God had brought this about, that this was what was going to happen, that what he had said would take place for Jacob. He had no questions. He fully believed it. So then Esau pitifully pleads with his dad to bless him too. And all Isaac can say is, look, your brother, he has to spell it out for him clearly. Your brother came deceitfully, and he's taken away your blessing. He's not whitewashing it in any way. He's telling, and this is the closest we get to the author's perspective on what has happened in the mouth of Isaac. This is deception. There's nothing to justify it. The author at no point tries to justify either Rebekah or Jacob's action. It is not justifiable. So Esau then turns from despair to rage, and he disparages Jacob's name, saying it's so fitting that he was called something like at the heels, because he's been at my heels two times now. First, it was my birthright that he took. Now he's taken my blessing. So he's going back and forth, and he goes from the rage again to despair, and he pitifully pleads again, can you still give me a blessing? And this is when you're reading, you realize how Isaac has set himself up. Because in his blessing, he's left nothing. His blessing was an all-encompassing blessing. That's the way he understood it. That's the way he meant it. He intended to give Esau everything. And he intended to give Jacob nothing. And now he's given it to Jacob. And he has nothing to offer Esau. And Esau kind of draws out. He's incredulous. He says, how can you have only one blessing? It's like he's saying, you have two sons. What were you thinking? And then Isaac just kind of pities him by saying all that he can think to say in verses 39 and 40. Then Isaac, his father, answered him and said to him, behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of the heavens on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck. So he basically repeats the first part of the blessing that he'd just given to Jacob, only he reverses it and he adds the words, your dwelling, which changes everything about what was said. It's not that he would experience the dew of the heaven and the fatness of the earth. He would be away from them. He would be without them. He would not have the material blessing that Jacob would have, and he would have to submit to Jacob. Only thing that he can offer him is to say that his people, that he is going to be a pugnacious little group of people who are going to eventually free themselves when they're fed up with their servitude. But that's all he can offer. That's all that he can say. It's almost a curse. So the question is, at the end of this story, who is in the right? Who's done the right thing in this mess? And who's the good guy? Is it Isaac? Think about Isaac. We don't know that Isaac knew about Rebekah's oracle. A lot of people assume that. Text never says. It says that the oracle was given to Rebekah. So you might not have known that. And the text is clear that Isaac believes God. He does have faith in God. Hebrews 11:20 isn't just blowing smoke when it says that by faith, Isaac invoked future blessings on Jacob and Esau. He did believe God's promises. See, he's acting in a way in faith here. See that when he says he shall be blessed. But obviously, Isaac's playing favorites. He should have invited both of his sons. Later on in chapter 49, Jacob is going to do the same thing, and he's going to invite all his sons. That's what you do. That's not what Isaac does. He's deliberately secretive. He intends to give Esau everything, as you can tell from his blessing. So his intentions were totally wrong. Can't justify Isaac's actions and behavior. What about Rebekah? You know, maybe she's a good example, because Rebekah does know what the Lord had said about these twins before they were born. She knows what God's plans were for them. And she knows that Isaac, she's just heard Isaac, and she knows that Isaac isn't acting in accord with God's promises. He's not acting in the way that fits with God's plan. So isn't it reasonable for her to step in at that point and say, you know, this isn't right. I need to make sure that God's plans are honored. Isn't that a way to honor the Lord? I can understand that reasoning if the Lord wasn't the almighty, all-wise creator and sustainer of the universe. It would make sense other than that reality that Genesis has thoroughly set us up to understand. So whether she realizes it or not, this God doesn't need her help. And sins of ignorance are still sins. So God's going to ensure that his plans go forward. He doesn't need us to step in and help those plans along, especially not by sinning. Even if we think it's just a minor sin, the ends never justify the means. Sin is never your only option either. We think that a certain situation might call us to sin. You know, we might have to sin in a certain situation. We're not thinking about God the right way. We're not seeing God the way that he is, the sovereign God, as he is. So if you think that you have to sin in some circumstance, you think, well, you know, if that happened, then I would just have to sin. Your God isn't as big as my God. There is never a time when you'd have to say that. You could say, well, how is Rebecca, what's she supposed to do? She's supposed to entrust herself and her son to God. She's supposed to trust God. That's what we're called to do. Despite any possible ignorance of how great God is, she should have entrusted herself and her son to God. And then there's Jacob. And you could make it seem like Jacob is honoring his mother, and he's just listening to his mom. And he's kind of caught up in this, right? And it's not his idea to do this. It was his mom's. And he does question it at one point, right? But why does he question it? Was it moral? No, he's just concerned that if he gets caught, it's going to be worse off for him. That was his only concern. That was his only problem with what was happening. Now, he never actually tells his mom, I can't dishonor my father this way. Now, you could set this up as a problem, right? Well, either he's going to honor his mother and listen to her, or he's going to honor his father, right? Except for you can never honor someone by sin. He can't honor his mother by obeying. He has to, and there are respectful ways to tell her, I can't do that to my father. But Jacob's not struggling with this morally. The only time, again, he has a problem is when it comes to getting caught. He's not concerned about the deceit. He's just concerned about himself. In fact, when his mom says she's going to take on the possible terrible consequences, what's his response? He's immediately okay. He's like, okay, I can live with that. You're going to take all the bad stuff? All right. So he doesn't show any concern for even his mom, who's very concerned about him. He just shows concern for himself, and he lies, he even blasphemes, no remorse. What about Esau? I mean, he's kind of a poor sap. He doesn't seem to be the mastermind that everybody else in this family is. He's just kind of taken up in things. But he cares very little about God and about God's plans and about God's blessing. Remember how adamant Abraham was that Isaac needed to get a wife from outside the land. Abraham believed God's promises. Abraham believed that God was going to give the land. He believed that God was going to give that exclusively to his descendants and take it away from the Canaanites. So he wanted to remain distinct. That's why he wanted Isaac to have a wife outside of the promised land, because he didn't want there to be any blurred lines. It's going to be clear that your descendants have this, not the Canaanites. And I am quite certain that Esau was aware of these promises. But he doesn't care about what God thought. And he doesn't seem to care about what his parents think. He's pursued this because of his own desires. And we already saw back in chapter 24 that he'd spurned God's blessing when he sold his birthright. He didn't think it was important. He didn't think it was valuable. And as much as you could feel sorry for Esau and being tricked out of his blessing, just remember, he was perfectly content when it was just him being blessed. He knows what's traditional. He knows that both sons are supposed to be there. He had no problem going out hunting to come back for his soul blessing. He only thinks it's a problem when he's the one who doesn't get the blessing. There are no good guys in the story. They're all guilty. Again, Esau foreshadowed the web. Isaac prepared it. Rebekah planned it. Jacob spun it. But we can't get upset when Isaac and Esau are caught in it. So it's a tangled web, and it really is tangled for them, but it isn't for God. So you notice one thing that's mentioned in here is God's providence. It's mentioned even though everybody else is ignoring it. Jacob sneaks it into his lie. You know, how'd you get here so fast? He says, because the Lord your God granted me success. He believes that the Lord could providentially arrange for the animal to be there just in time so that he could have done. It's a plausible idea. That's why he uses it as an excuse. So he believes in the potentiality of God's providence, but he's not living like he believes God's providence. God is the one who granted me success. You mean the God who, before you were born, said who was going to experience that supremacy? So Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, Esau, you meant it for evil, but the Lord, he meant it for good. You see, nothing in God's plans have been adjusted or changed. We're going to see the consequences for Rebecca and Jacob's actions. There are consequences for what they've done. Their evil actions have brought about God's plans, but they're still guilty for their sin. They're accountable for it. They're going to be punished for it. But they hadn't in any way derailed God's plans. All this conniving fits seamlessly with what God is accomplishing. What God wanted to happen took place, even though he doesn't want them to sin to do it. That's the amazing mystery of it all. That their evil could bring about God's good. And that is actually good news, even though it's hard, because we know it doesn't mean that we're puppets any more than any of these patriarchal members are puppets. But it's hard for us to understand how these two realities can be true. How can God be sovereign over our actions and yet we're still responsible? One of them seems like it has to be more true. One of them has to kind of contradict the others. Reality is that neither of those contradict each other. And it would seem, again, from our standpoint, that if God is truly this sovereign, then he's responsible for our actions and we aren't. Or if we're really responsible for our actions, then God can't be this sovereign. That's the logic that we conclude from this. And yet, what the Bible consistently teaches is that both of these are true. Now, if you and I, or if any of us, could plumb the depths of God's infinite sovereignty, his infinite being, if we could plumb the depths of that, we could know God in that deepest way, then we would have a case. We would be able to say, oh, no, here's the way things really are. But none of us can do that. We're all finite. And it actually is arrogant for us to say that we can evaluate God's revelation and say, this can't be. We have to be able to take what God clearly teaches, and either we accept that this is from God, and we take it by faith that this is a reality that's beyond us, and we believe that there is actually a God who is greater than us, who can do things in ways that we can't understand. We have to take that on faith, or we have to say, I don't believe. But we have to be willing, we should be willing, I should say, to embrace mystery as finite creatures. What does that mean for us? That means that we can rest from worrying about what this or that person's going to do to us. There's so many things that are outside of our control. So many things you can think, what happens if this person does this or if that person does that? And the reality is that this passage is teaching us that we don't actually have to worry. That nothing can happen to us outside of God's plans for us. And we know that God's plans for us and God does everything. He accomplishes everything for his glory and for the good of those who love him. And we can accept that, embrace that in faith. That means we don't have to get worried. It does not mean that bad things aren't going to happen. But it does mean that even when the bad things happen, that God is not dispassionate. God doesn't care about you. God cares about you still. And he is at work even in that bad for your good. As hard as that is to understand at times. But we can embrace that. We should embrace that. And we can only embrace that if we believe that God is as sovereign as he is in this passage. Now, if you don't know God personally through his son, understand what Jesus has done. He did what Rebecca said she was going to do. Jesus actually took the curse of others, the curse that others deserve. We've all been caught by God. He knows about our sin. We are under God's curse. Jesus came. He lived a perfect life. He lived the life that deserves God's eternal blessing. And yet, he died and rose again to take the curse of everyone who recognizes their sinners, that they are under God's curse, and says, I shouldn't be this way, and turns and trusts in what Jesus did in dying and rising again. And Jesus did that to give them that eternal blessing. So I would, again, urge you to respond to that. Don't just keep living your life the way that you think you should live it. Trust in Jesus. And I would encourage you to do that now. To respond now, because Esau is actually an example of somebody who ran out of opportunities. Passage that I read this morning in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 17, points back to this tearful moment. And it says, at this moment, there was no repentance available to him. He spurned God's blessing. He said, God, I don't care. He turned his back on God when he sold his birthright. He turned his back on God when he married the Canaanites. And at this point, text says that he had no repentance available to him, though he sought it with tears. May that not be true of anyone here. Join me in prayer. Father, we are thankful that you are a good God, that we know of no goodness apart from who you are. So, Father, I pray that you would keep us from critiquing your goodness and instead critique ourselves in light of your goodness. We thank you that you're a God who reveals intricacies that we cannot fully understand, but that we can still affirm. Pray, Father, that you would grant us the humility to accept what you have taught and to accept the reality that we may not be able to go beyond that. And instead, we would find in this something that we can be excited about, not something that's just too hard to understand that we don't want to embrace. That we would recognize that it is good that you are sovereign, that you are the Lord God Almighty, who reigns on your throne, that we would not be afraid of that, that we would glory in that and rest in it. Father, I pray for those that do not know you, that as they hear the good news of your son, that they would respond to it while it is still called today. They would recognize truth by your word and by your spirit. It's through your son we ask it. Amen.